parent, if he wants to go on ruling, must be prepared to remove all these people until he is left with no one who is any use, whether friend or enemy. Obviously, he must. He will need a sharp pair of eyes then. He needs to pick out the brave, the noble, the wise, and the rich, since it is his unavoidable good fortune, whether he likes it or not, to be the enemy of all of them. He must plot their downfall until he has got the city clean. A fine way to clean a city, he said. Yes, the exact opposite of what doctors do to the body. They remove what is worst and leave what is best. With the tyrant, it is the other way round. That's what he has to do, apparently, if he is to go on ruling. In which case, I said, he is firmly and inevitably impaled on the horns of a delightful dilemma, which requires him either to spend his life with the worthless mob and be hated by them into the bargain, or not to live at all. That's about the size of it, he said. And the more hated by the citizens his behaviour makes him, the larger and more reliable a bodyguard he will need, won't he? Of course. Who are these reliable people, then? Where can he send to for them? They'll come winging their way of their own accord, he said, any number of them, as long as he pays the going rate. Dog's teeth. Drones again. Foreign ones, all kinds of them, I think you're talking about. Good. I haven't given you the wrong impression, then. And from the city itself, might he not bring himself... to do what? To deprive the citizens of their slaves, set the slaves free, and make them part of his bodyguard? Indeed he might. They are, after all, the most reliable he can find. What a wonderful thing you make a tyrant out to be, I said, if these are the people he has as his friends, the people he can trust, once he has destroyed the friends he started with. Well, these certainly are the kind of friends he has. So, while he enjoys the admiration of these friends and the company of these new citizens, do decent people hate him and avoid him? How can they help doing so? We have strayed from the point, however, I said. Let's return to that army the tyrant has, that fine, large, varied and ever-changing army, and ask how it is going to be maintained. Well, obviously, if there's money in the city's temples, then as long as it lasts, he will spend that, plus the money of his victims, allowing him to exact smaller contributions from the people. But what happens when these run out? He will use his father's money, obviously, to support himself, his drinking companions, and his male and female friends. I see. You mean the people who spawned the tyrant will support him and his friends. It will have no choice, he said. What if the people resent this? I asked. It is not right, they might say for a start, for a grown-up son to be supported by his father. Quite the reverse, in fact. A father should be supported by his son. What is more, the reason we fathered you and put you in power was not so that we could ourselves become slaves to our own slaves, as soon as you became powerful, and support you and them and the rest of your collection of human flotsam. We order you to leave the city now, you and your friends. What do you think would happen then? My God, he said. Then the people really will find out what they are and what kind of offspring they have fathered, taken to their hearts and allowed to grow. What do you mean? I asked. Will the tyrant use force against his parent? Will he beat him if he disobeys? Yes, once he has taken away his weapons. A parricide, then, this tyrant you are describing, a cruel guardian for man's old age. At this point, it seems, the thing is an acknowledged tyranny. The people have jumped out of the proverbial frying pan into the fire, from their enslavement to free men, to a despotism of slaves. Yes, that is how it happens. Will there be any objection, then, I asked, to our saying that we have given an adequate description of the way tyranny evolves out of democracy, and of what it is like when it has done so? No, he said. Our description is perfectly adequate. This is your moment, then, I said. Your time has finally come, like the judge of the contest making the final decision. There are five contenders, the kingly, the timocratic, the oligarchic, the democratic, and the tyrannical. In terms of happiness, which of them, in your opinion, comes first? Which comes second, and so on with the other places? That's not a difficult decision. In terms of goodness and badness and happiness and its opposite, I rank them, like choruses, in order of their appearance. Shall we hire a herald, then? I asked. Or shall I announce the result myself? The verdict of the son of Ariston is this. The best and most just character is the happiest. This is the one who is the most kingly, the one who is king over himself. The worst and most unjust is the unhappiest, and he is, in fact, the one with the most tyrannical nature, the one who is the greatest tyrant over himself and his city. Thank you, he said. Let's take it that the announcement has been made. And shall I add a clause saying, whether or not they escape detection in the sight of all men and gods? Yes, do add that clause. Very well, I said. Let that stand as one proof for us. Now, have a look at this second proof, and see if you think it has any force. How does the proof go? Like this. The three parts of the soul seem to me to have three forms of pleasure, one for each individual part. Likewise, three forms of desire, and three forms of rule. Can you explain that? The first element, we say, is the one which allows a man to learn. The second, the part which allows him to act in a spirited way. To the third, on account of its diversity, we found it impossible to give its own unique name, so we gave it the name of its largest and strongest element. We called it desiring, because of the strength of its desires for food, drink, sex, and everything that goes with these, and money-loving, because money is the principal means of satisfying these desires. And we were right, he said. So, if we were to say that the thing it took pleasure and delight in was profit, would that be our best way of concentrating our argument under one general heading? Would that make it clear to ourselves what we mean when we talk about this part of the soul? And if we were to call it money-loving and profit-loving, would we be justified? Well, I certainly think we would. What about the spirited part? Can we say, by contrast, that its sole and constant aim is power, victory, and reputation? Yes, we can. So if we called it a lover of victory and a lover of honour, would that be appropriate? Absolutely appropriate. And, of course, it's obvious to anyone that the part we learn with is entirely and constantly intent upon knowing where the truth lies, and that of the three it is the least concerned with money and reputation. Easily the least. Would it be in order, then, for us to call it a lover of learning and a lover of wisdom? It would. Very well, I said. Is this the ruling element in some people's souls, and is one of the other two elements, it could be either, dominant in others? Yes, he said. Does this explain why we say that there are three fundamental human types, the lover of wisdom, the lover of victory, and the lover of profit? Of course. And three classes of pleasures, one corresponding to each type. Exactly. You realise, I said, that if you took the trouble to ask three people of this sort, one after another, which of these lives is the most pleasant, each would sing the loudest praises of his own. Certainly the money-maker will say that in comparison with profit, the pleasures of honour and learning are worthless, unless there is something in them which can make money. True. What about the lover of honour? I asked. Doesn't he regard the pleasure which depends on money as sordid, and the pleasure which depends on learning, except to the extent that learning brings reputation, as a load of hot air? He does. As for the lover of wisdom, or philosopher, I said, what view do we imagine he takes of the other pleasures, compared with the pleasure of knowing where the truth lies, and always enjoying some similar sort of pleasure while he is learning it? Won't he regard them as far inferior? And won't he call them truly necessary or compulsory, since, but for necessity, he could go on perfectly well without them? Yes, he said, we can be confident this is his view. Now think about it. Here are three men. Which of them has most experience of all the pleasures we have mentioned? Does the lover of profit learn about the nature of truth itself? Do you think he has more experience of the pleasure of knowledge than the lover of wisdom has of the pleasure of making money? There's no comparison, he said. The lover of wisdom is compelled to taste both pleasures right from his earliest years. The lover of profit, on the other hand, is not compelled to learn about the nature of things or taste and experience the sweetness of this pleasure. Even if he really wanted to, he would find it difficult. In which case, I said, when it comes to experience of both sets of pleasures, the lover of wisdom has a great advantage over the lover of profit. Yes, a great advantage. And does he have an advantage over the lover of honour? Or does he have less experience of the pleasures of being respected than the lover of honour has of the pleasure of knowledge? No, he said, if they accomplish what each individually sets out to achieve, they all find that recognition follows. The rich man is widely respected, so is the courageous man, and so is the wise man. So they all experience the pleasure of being respected. They all know what it is like. But only the lover of wisdom, the philosopher, is in the position of having tasted the contemplation of what is and the pleasure it brings. On grounds of experience, then, I said, he is the best judge out of these men. Much the best. What is more, won't he be the only one whose experience has been accompanied by reflection? Of course. And the instrument with which judgment should be made does not belong to the lover of profit or the lover of honour, but to the lover of wisdom. What instrument is that? We said judgment should be made using reasoned arguments, didn't we? Yes, and reasoning is essentially the instrument of the philosopher, the lover of wisdom. Of course. If wealth and profit were the best means of deciding questions, the truest recommendations or criticisms would necessarily be those of the lover of profit. Necessarily. And if honour and victory and courage were the best means, wouldn't the truest recommendations be those of the lover of honour or lover of victory? Obviously. But since experience, reflection, and reasoning are the best means, the truest recommendations will necessarily be those of the lover of wisdom and lover of reasoning, he said. Of these three pleasures, then, will the one belonging to the part of the soul with which we learn be the most enjoyable? And does the person in whom this part rules have the most enjoyable life? How can he fail to? He said. At the very least, he's certainly giving an expert opinion, the reflective man, when he recommends his own life. Which life does our judge put in second place, and which pleasure? The pleasure of the warlike lover of honour, obviously. It is closer to him than the pleasure of the moneymaker. So he puts the lover of profit's pleasure third, apparently. Yes, of course, he said. That's two wins out of two, then, for the just over the unjust. Now, we come to the third round. If you think about pleasure, you can see that for anyone other than the wise, it is not true and pure, but a kind of shadow picture. Or so I think I've been told by some expert. Explain, please, why pleasure is a shadow picture. Don't we say that pain is the opposite of pleasure? We certainly do, and that there is such a thing as feeling neither pleasure nor pain. Yes, intermediate between those two, a kind of rest or respite for the soul from pain and pleasure. Or isn't that how you would describe it? That is how I would describe it, he said. Think of the things people who are ill say at times when they are ill. What sort of things? That there is no greater pleasure than good health, but that they hadn't realized it was the greatest pleasure until they were ill. Yes, I do remember hearing people say that, he said. And have you heard people in the grip of some agonizing pain saying that there is no pleasure to compare with relief from agony? Yes, I've heard that. I expect you can think of plenty of similar painful situations people find themselves in, where the pleasure they praise most highly is the absence of pain, a rest from pain, rather than any enjoyment. Yes, at times like that, maybe rest becomes something pleasant and delightful. So too, when someone stops feeling enjoyment, the rest from pleasure will be painful. Possibly, he said. In which case, this thing we described just now as intermediate between the two, this rest or respite, will at one time or another be both those things, both pain and pleasure. Apparently. Is it really possible for something which is neither of those things to come to be both of them? I don't think so. So it's not that this rest or respite is pleasant. It seems pleasant beside what is painful, and painful beside what is pleasant. As far as the truth about pleasure goes, there is nothing sound or reliable in these illusions. It's all sorcery. That's what the argument suggests, at any rate, he said. Well, take a look at pleasures which are not preceded by pain, I said. I wouldn't want you to think in this context that it is the nature of pleasure simply to be the cessation of pain, and of pain simply to be the cessation of pleasure. What sort of pleasures do you mean? Where are they? There are any number of them, I said, but you might like to think particularly about the pleasures of smell. You don't have to have felt pain beforehand. They come out of the blue, they are incredibly powerful, and when they are over, they leave no pain behind. Absolutely true. We shouldn't accept, then, that pure pleasure is a release from pain, or pain a release from pleasure. No, we shouldn't. However, of the so-called pleasures which reach the soul through the body, surely the most numerous and powerful are of this type, some sort of relief from pain. Yes, they are. Very well. And are anticipated pleasures and pains caused by the expectation of some future relief from pain or pleasure of the same nature? They are. Do you know what sort of thing these pleasures and pains are, then, I asked, and what they most resemble? What? Do you believe the world contains a top, a bottom, and something in between? Yes, I do. Don't you think if someone were taken from the bottom to the middle, he'd be bound to think he was travelling to the top? And standing in the middle looking back at where he'd come from, wouldn't he be bound to think he was at the top, if he hadn't seen the real top? If you ask me, he said, that's exactly what someone would think in that situation. And if he were taken back again, I asked, would he think, and think rightly, that he was travelling to the bottom? Of course he would. Would the cause of all this be his not having experienced the true range of top, middle and bottom? Obviously. In which case, would it surprise you to find that people with no knowledge of truth are the same? They have unsound opinions on all sorts of subjects, and their condition, when it comes to pleasure, pain, and what is in between, is such that when they move in the direction of what is painful, their supposition is true. They really are in pain. But when they move from pain to what is in between, they are firmly convinced they have reached fulfillment and pleasure. It's like comparing black and grey when you have no knowledge of white. Lacking any knowledge of pleasure, they compare the absence of pain with pain and come to the wrong conclusion. Would it surprise me, he said? Good heavens, no. It would surprise me much more if it weren't like that. Think of it like this, I said. Aren't hunger and thirst and things like that a kind of emptiness, an empty condition of the body? Yes, of course they are. Aren't ignorance and stupidity likewise an empty condition of the soul? They certainly are. And how are people filled? By taking in food, by gaining understanding? Of course. Which gives the truer fulfillment, that which is more something or that which is less something? Obviously, that which is more something. Which kinds of thing, then, do you think have a greater share in pure being? Things like bread, drink, cooked food and nourishment in general, or the kind made up of opinion, knowledge, understanding, and in fact the whole of human excellence? The choice you have to make is this: which do you think is more something? That which is connected with what is always the same, immortal and true, itself possessing these qualities and being found in the context of things with these qualities, or that which is connected with what is never the same and mortal, itself possessing those qualities and being found in the context of things with those qualities? That which is connected with what is always the same is far superior, he said. Well, does anything have a greater share in the being of what is always the same than knowledge does? No. Does anything have a greater share in truth than knowledge does? Again, no. And if anything has a smaller share in truth, doesn't it also have a smaller share in being? Necessarily. As a general rule, then, will the kinds of things involved in care of the body have a smaller share, both of truth and of being, than the kinds involved in care of the soul? Much smaller. And don't you think the body itself has a smaller share than the soul has? Yes, I do. Very well. Is what is filled with things which have more being, and itself has more being, more genuinely filled than what is filled with things which have less being, and itself has less being? Of course. So, if being filled with things appropriate to our nature is pleasurable, then that which is more genuinely filled and filled with things which have more being would make people more truly and genuinely happy, giving them true pleasure. Whereas that which takes in things which have less being would be less truly and lastingly filled, and get hold of a pleasure which was less trustworthy and less true. That inescapably follows, he said. If the entire soul, then, follows without rebellion the part which loves wisdom, the result is that each part can in general carry out its own functions, can be just, in other words, and in particular each is able to enjoy pleasures which are its own, the best, and as far as possible, the truest. Absolutely. When one of the other parts takes control, there are two results. It fails to discover its own proper pleasure, and it compels the other parts to pursue a pleasure which is not their own and not true. That's right, he said. Would this result be most noticeable with those elements which are furthest removed from philosophy and reason? Yes, easily the most. And isn't the element furthest removed from reason the one which is furthest removed from law and order? Obviously. Wasn't it the lustful and tyrannical desires which were clearly revealed to be the furthest removed? Much the furthest. And the kingly and orderly desires which were the least far removed? Yes. In which case, I imagine, the tyrant will be furthest removed from true pleasure, his own proper pleasure, while the king will be least far removed. Bound to be. So, the most unpleasant life, I said, will be the tyrant's, and the most pleasant will be the king's. Absolutely bound to be. And if the good and just man is so far ahead of the bad and unjust in terms of pleasure, won't he be an unbelievable distance ahead of him in the grace, beauty, and excellence of his life? Yes. An unbelievable distance. A great prize is at stake, Glaucon, greater than people realize for being good rather than bad. We shouldn't be led by success, money, power, or even poetry into neglecting justice or virtue in general. After what we've said today, I agree, so would anyone else, I imagine. And that's without even mentioning the greatest of the rewards and prizes which are on offer for virtue. Greater than we can imagine, you must mean, if there are other rewards greater than the ones we've described. Nothing great can happen in a short space of time, I said, and presumably, compared with eternity, our whole span of time from childhood to old age is a short space of time. A mere nothing, he said. Well then, do you think something which is immortal should be seriously interested in this short period of time and not in the whole of time? No, I think he should be interested in the whole of time. What are you getting at? This. That the soul is something immortal is a conclusion we might be driven to both by this recent argument and by other arguments. But if we want to know what it's really like, we shouldn't look at it in the form we currently see it in, crippled by its partnership with the body and other evils. No, Glaucon, we should be looking in a different direction. Which direction? He said. We should look to the soul's love of wisdom. We should bear in mind what it clings to, the kind of company it yearns for, since it is kin to that which is divine, immortal, and always existing, and what it could become if it devoted itself entirely to this. Then you would see the soul's true nature, whether it is complex or simple, or however exactly it is. For the moment, however, I think we have given an adequate description of the things that can happen to it, the shapes it can assume in human life. We certainly have, he said. There you are, then, I said. In the course of our discussion, we have removed the various objections to our claim. We haven't had to resort to the rewards and reputation of justice, as you were saying Homer and Hesiod did. Haven't we found that the thing itself, justice, is best for the soul itself, and that the soul should do what is just, whether or not it possesses the ring of Gyges, or even the ring of Gyges and the cap of Hades? Very true, we have. In which case, Glaucon, can there still be any objection to our going further, and restoring to justice and the rest of virtue the great rewards which they characteristically bring to the soul during a man's lifetime? No, no objection, he said. But these are nothing, I said, in number or magnitude when compared with the rewards and punishments which await the just and the unjust after death. You ought to hear those too, if each is to receive in full the payment the argument owes him. Please tell us, he said. I can think of few things I'd rather hear about. Well, it's not the tale of an ancient mariner, I'm going to tell you, more the tale of an ancient foreigner. A hero from Pamphylia, the son of Arminius. He was killed in battle, and on the 10th day, when the dead, by now decomposed, were taken up for burial, his body was found to be perfectly sound. He was taken home. And on the 12th day, as he was lying on the funeral pyre, ready for burial, he came to life again. And having come to life, he told people what he had seen in the place where he had been. He said that when his soul left his body, it went on a journey, with many others like it, until they came to a wonderful place where there were two openings side by side in the ground, and two others up above in the heavens, corresponding to these. In between were seated judges, who, when they gave their judgments, ordered the just to take the way which led to the right and upwards through the heavens, and to wear on their front the marks of the judgments made about them. The unjust they ordered to take the left hand, downward way, and they too wore on their backs the marks of everything they had done. When he himself stepped forward, they said they wanted him to act as a messenger to mankind, to tell them what was going on there. They urged him to hear and observe everything which happened in that place. There he saw souls departing as judgment was passed on them through the two exits, the opening in the heavens and the opening in the ground. Meanwhile, through the other two openings, souls were either rising up, parched and dusty in appearance from the one in the ground, or coming down all clean from the one in the heavens. The ones who were just arriving looked as if they'd got there after a long journey. They were very glad to come out into the meadow and camp there, as if they were at a festival. They greeted one another, those who were acquainted, and exchanged news. Those coming out of the ground asked the others about things up there, while those coming from the heavens asked them in return how things were where they had been. As they exchanged accounts, the first group were wailing and weeping as they recalled all the terrible things they had seen and experienced in their journey, their thousand-year journey beneath the earth. Those who had come from the heavens, by contrast, were recounting the wonderful things that had happened to them and the indescribably beautiful sights they had seen. To give a full account, Glaucon, would take a very long time, but the main point, he said, was this. Whatever wrongs they had done anyone, and whatever people they had all wronged, for all these in turn they had to pay a penalty. 10 times over for each offence. 10 periods of 100 years each, in other words, this being the measure of a human life. This made sure they would pay a 10-fold payment for the offence. For example, if any of them had been guilty of the deaths of many people, betraying cities or armies and casting people into slavery, perhaps, or playing a part in any other cruelty, on all these counts they earned 10-fold pain for each offence. Equally, due rewards were earned for any good deeds and for showing themselves just and holy. And he said something, though nothing of note, about those who died at birth or lived only a short time. He also described the still greater rewards and penalties for piety or impiety towards gods and parents, and for murder. He said he came across one person who was being asked by another where Ardiaeus the Great was. This Ardiaeus had been tyrant in some city in Pamphylia 1,000 years before. He had killed his aged father and his older brother and done many other wicked deeds, so it was said. "He has not come to this place," replied the one being asked, "nor will he ever come. That was one of the appalling sights we saw. When we had been through everything we had to go through and were close to the opening just about to come up, we suddenly caught sight of Ardiaeus and some others. They were tyrants, most of them, though there were some private citizens who had committed heinous crimes. When these people thought it was their turn to go up, the opening refused to allow them through. Its mouth gave a loud roar whenever one of these irredeemably wicked people and said they were going to be thrown into Tartarus. He said that for each of them, out of the whole range of fears they were exposed to in that place, this was the greatest, that when they came up to the opening, the sound might be heard, and each of them was only too glad to pass through in silence. So much, then, for the kinds of penalties and punishments and the corresponding rewards. For each group, the stay in the meadow lasted 7 days. At the end of it, on the 8th day, they had to get up and go on a journey, arriving, after 4 days, at a place from which they could see a shaft of light, like a pillar, extending from above through the whole heaven and earth. The light was more like a rainbow than anything else, only brighter and more pure. A day's journey brought them to where the light was, and there, in the middle of the light, they could see, extended from heaven, the extremities of its chains. This light binds the heavens. It's like the cables of a trireme, in the way it holds the whole revolving firmament together. And from the extremities they saw extended the spindle of necessity, by which all the separate rotations are set in motion. The shaft and hook of the spindle are of adamant. The whirl is partly of adamant and partly of other materials. The nature of the whirl is as follows. In appearance, it is like the whirls we have here, but from what he said, we have to think of it like this. Imagine a single large whirl, which has been completely hollowed out with a chisel, and a second, smaller whirl inside it, fitting exactly into it, like those pots that fit inside one another. Similarly, a third, fourth, and then 4 more, making a total of 8 whirls in all, one inside another. Their rims show as so many circles from above and form a single whirl round the shaft with a continuous surface. The shaft is driven right through the middle of the 8th whirl. The first and outermost whirl is the broadest in terms of the breadth of the circular rim. The rim of the 6th comes second. The fourth rim comes third, the eighth rim comes fourth, the seventh rim comes fifth, the fifth rim comes sixth, the third rim comes seventh, and the second comes eighth. The rim of the largest whirl is spangled. That of the seventh is the brightest. That of the eighth derives its colour from the seventh shining on it. The second and fifth are very similar to one another and yellower than the others. The third has the whitest light, the fourth is reddish, and the sixth is the next whitest after the third. The spindle is rotating. Seen as a whole, it all goes round at the same speed, but within the whole, as it revolves, the seven inner circles are gently revolving in the opposite direction to the whole. Of these inner circles, number 8 turns fastest, followed by numbers 7, 6, and 5, which all travel at the same speed. Third in the speed of its counter-rotation, as it appeared to them, was the fourth whirl. Fourth was number 3, and fifth number 2. The spindle itself turns in the lap of necessity. On the rim of each of its circles is perched a siren, who is carried round with it, uttering a single sound, a single musical note. All 8 together combine to produce one single harmony. There are 3 others seated in a circle at equal distances, each on a throne. These are the Fates, the daughters of necessity: Lachesis, Clotho, and Atropos. They are clothed in white with garlands on their heads, and they sing to the accompaniment of the sirens. Lachesis sings of the past, Clotho of the present, and Atropos of the future. Clotho has her right hand on the outer circumference of the spindle, turning it at intervals. Atropos, with her left hand, does the same for the inner rims. Lachesis touches both inner and outer in turn, one with each hand. They, themselves, when they arrived, had immediately to go before Lachesis. A kind of prophet or speaker started off by lining them up. Then from the lap of Lachesis he took numbers for drawing lots and patterns of lives. Ascending a high platform, he began to speak. The word of the maiden Lachesis, daughter of necessity. Souls, creatures of a day, here begins another cycle of mortal life and the death it brings. Your guardian spirit will not be given to you by lot. You will choose a guardian spirit for yourselves. Let the one who draws the first lot be the first to choose a life. He will then be joined to it by necessity. Virtue knows no master. Your respect or contempt for it will give each of you a greater or smaller share. The choice makes you responsible. God is not responsible. With these words he threw the lots among them all, and each picked up the lot which fell closest to him. All except Ur. He was not allowed to pick one up, but anyone who did pick one up could see clearly what number lot he had drawn. Next he spread the patterns of lives before them on the ground. There were many more of them than there were people present, and they were of every possible kind, lives of all the animals in addition to all the human lives. There were lives of tyrants among them, some lasting, others destroyed in mid-career and ending in poverty and exile, or beggary. There were lives of men distinguished, some for their looks, beauty, and in general for their strength and prowess, others for their families and the virtues of their ancestors. Lives of men who by the same criteria were not distinguished, and a similar range of women's lives as well. The overall disposition of the soul was not part of the life, because the soul is affected by the kind of life it chooses. But the other characteristics were mingled with one another, with wealth and poverty, disease and health, or with some balance between these extremes. It looks, my dear Glaucon, as if that is where the whole danger lies for a man. It is why the greatest care must be directed towards having each and every one of us disregard all other branches of study and be a follower and student of this branch of ours, in the hope that he can find and discover someone who will give him the ability and knowledge to distinguish the good life from the bad. and choose always and everywhere out of all those possible the life which is better. He must take into consideration all the things we have talked about here today, comparing them with one another and choosing between them in terms of excellence of life. He needs to know what the effect is, for good or bad, of beauty when mingled with poverty or riches, and what the effect is of noble or ignoble birth, of private life or public office, of strength or weakness, of ease or difficulty of learning, and all such matters as are connected with the soul, either by nature or acquisition, when they are all mingled with one another. Taking all these things into consideration, he must be able to choose, defining the worse and better life with reference to the nature of the soul, calling that worse which leads the soul along the road to greater injustice, and that better which leads along the road to greater justice. He will pay no attention to anything else. After all, this is the crucial choice, as we have seen, both during his lifetime and after his death. Fast as adamant must he hold to this opinion as he goes to Hades, so that even there he can avoid being distracted by evils like wealth, and so plunging into the sort of behaviour, tyranny in particular, which will make him commit countless crimes for which there is no remedy, and suffer an even worse fate himself. No, he will know how to choose the middle way in such matters, avoiding the two extremes both in this life, as far as he can, and in the whole of the life hereafter. This is the way to the greatest happiness for a man. The next thing the speaker had to say, according to this messenger from the afterworld, was this. Even the last to come forward, provided he chooses sensibly and lives with integrity, has a worthwhile life before him, not a bad life. There is no cause for carelessness if you choose first, no cause for despair if you choose last. When he finished speaking, the person who had drawn the first lot came straight up and chose the greatest tyranny. In his folly and greed, he did not look hard enough at what he was choosing. He had not seen that within its fate was included, among other evils, the devouring of his own children. When he did have time to look at it, he beat his breast and lamented his choice, in defiance of the instructions the speaker had issued earlier. He didn't blame himself for his misfortunes. He blamed fate, the gods, anything rather than himself. He was one of those who had come from the heavens, and in his previous life he had lived in a well-ordered society. He had had his share of virtue, but it had been a matter of habit rather than philosophy. Generally speaking, the bulk of those caught in this kind of predicament were those who had come from heaven, since they were without the experience of hardship. Most of those who came from the earth, having both suffered themselves and seen others suffer, were in no hurry to make their choice. For this reason, and because of the way the lot fell out, for the majority of the souls there was an alternation between good and evil. However, if there is anyone who every time he enters this life here consistently pursues philosophy in the right way, then provided the way the lot falls out does not put him among the last to choose, the chances are, if Er's report is correct, not only that he will be happy here, but also that his journey from here to there and back again will be along the smooth heavenly road, not the rough terrestrial one. This choice of lives among the various souls, Er said, was a sight well worth seeing, and one which commanded pity, laughter, and amazement. For the most part, their choice matched the character and habits of their previous life. He saw the soul of what had once been Orpheus choose the life of a swan. His death at the hands of women had given him a hatred of the female sex, and he refused to be conceived and born of a woman again. He saw the soul of Thamyris choose the life of a nightingale. He saw a swan choose a human life by way of a change, and the same with other musical creatures. The soul which drew number 20 in the lottery chose the life of a lion. This was the soul of Ajax, the son of Telamon. shunning the life of a man as he remembered the decision over the weapons. The one after him was the soul of Agamemnon. Because of what had happened to it, this soul too had a hatred of the human race. It chose the life of an eagle instead. The soul of Atalanta had drawn a number somewhere in the middle. When she saw the wonderful prizes of a man who was an athlete, she couldn't resist them, and chose those. And after her he saw the soul of Epeus, the son of Panopeus, taking on the nature of a woman skilled in the arts. Among the very last to choose, he saw the soul of that clown, Thersites, taking the form of a monkey. He also saw the soul of Odysseus, which, as it turned out, had drawn the last lot of all, coming up to make its choice. Remembering the hardships of its previous life, it rejected ambition and spent a long time wandering round looking for the life of a private citizen who minded his own business. After a long search, he found one lying somewhere. It had been rejected by everyone else. When he saw it, he chose it gladly, saying he would have done the same even if he had drawn the first lot. Similarly, among the wild animals, there were moves into human beings and into one another, the unjust changing into savage creatures, the just into gentle ones. Every kind of intermingling was taking place. When all the souls had chosen their lives, they approached Lachesis in the same order they had made their choices. She gave each the guardian spirit it had chosen, to go with it, watch over its life, and fulfil its choices. This spirit first brought the soul before Clotho, passing beneath her hand and the whirl of the revolving spindle, to confirm the fate which the lot had allowed it to choose. When the soul had touched her, the spirit took it to where Atropos was spinning, so making the spun thread impossible to unwind, and from there, without turning back, it went beneath the throne of necessity. When it had been under that, and when the other souls had passed through as well, they all travelled to the plane of forgetting, through terrible, stifling heat, since the plane is devoid of trees or anything else the earth brings forth. By now it was getting to be evening, so they camped by the river of lost cares, whose water no vessel can hold. Drinking a limited amount of the water was compulsory for all of them, but those who were not saved by reason drank more than a limited amount, and as each drank, he forgot everything he had seen. They went to sleep, and around the middle of the night there was a thunderstorm and an earthquake, and they were suddenly carried away from there upwards to their berths, all in different directions, like shooting stars. Himself was not allowed to drink any of the water. As for where and how he returned to his body, he didn't know. All of a sudden he woke up and found himself, early in the morning, lying on his funeral pyre. In this way, Glaucon, his story was saved and not lost. And so it can be our salvation, since, if we believe it, we shall pass the river of forgetting in the right way, without polluting our souls. And if we take my advice, we shall believe that the soul is immortal, and capable of coping with all evils and all goods, and we shall keep always to the upper way, doing whatever we can to practice justice with wisdom. That way we shall be friends to ourselves and to the gods, both while we remain here and when we carry off our prizes afterwards, like winning athletes on their victory tour. And so, here, and on the thousand-year journey we have described, let us farewell.